History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We should know by now that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. We just need to take the initiative to ask a few questions, then invest a little time in listening. What we see is that those long buried memories just might take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only do we become educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It is, of course, Memorial Day weekend when our country pauses to remember. Since our founding nearly 250 years ago, more than 1 million Americans have given what President Abraham Lincoln famously labeled their last full measure of devotion, sacrificing their very lives for the rest of us and for the freedom our flag represents. If you haven't planned to yet, do a little digging today for Memorial Day events in your area, and our program's going to tell the story of some of the Gold Star heroes of World War II today. Of course, the very first day that America was drawn into World War II, more than 2,400 paid that ultimate price at Pearl Harbor. That included the entire band from the battleship USS Arizona, including a talented young man from Lindsay, California. John Adams would become a Navy pilot, but he lost his closest friend on December 7th, 1941.
My best friend was in the Navy, and he was stationed aboard the battleship Arizona, Harvey Sanderson.
Harvey Sanderson.
Mm-hmm.
And was he one of the reasons you got into the Navy?
No, I don't think so. It might have been a subconscious reason. I developed an interest in good music, and he was a musician. As a matter of fact, when he was in high school, we were fortunate enough to have Hugo Flock as the instructor, and he was a German music instructor from Visalia, and he was a chicken farmer. So every day he would go to the Lindsay schools, and he started me in music. I think it was in the third or fourth grade.
What'd you play?
Clarinet.
Clarinet. All right.
And Harvey was a clarinetist. Harvey went to the state. It was a group of high schools, musicians, going in this particular case, I think San Francisco.
It was like some kind of state honor band or
that's
something?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
And Harvey got first place 2 years in a row.
So he's the best high school clarinetist in the state.
Yes, right. Then he joined the Navy, and I went to the Navy School of Music, and he got into a Navy band, and he was aboard Arizona when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. So December 7th, 1941, you're back here in California.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
See, that was on a Sunday, as I recall. I was, we'd just gotten home from church. I was sitting in the living room listening to the news, and they interrupted what was going on to announce that Pearl Harbor had just been bombed. So, of course, we didn't know what the damage was, and that's the first I'd heard of it.
Did you know that that's where Harvey was?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, Harvey was home about a month before, and he said they were going to Pearl Harbor. And unfortunately, his father died about a week before, or just a few days before Pearl Harbor. And had she sent a message to the Navy, they would have sent him home.
Wow.
But she didn't, and I remember her telling me, she says, no, he was home just a month ago, and, you know, just don't bother him. And so that's the way that turned out, and she had to live with that the rest of her days.
Yeah. So heavy.
Yeah.
How much were you able to learn about what he'd been doing before the attack and or where he was when it happened? Did you get any kind of insight into what happened to him?
Well, I do know his station, his battle station was in the ammunition down below, handling ammunition, passing ammunition. So that's where he would be.
Which would have left him virtually zero chance at survival.
Oh, yeah.
When the Arizona was hit.
Mm-hmm.
But Was it the night before he'd been performing a concert with the band there?
Yeah, in Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
And a mutual friend of ours and grew up with us and was in the Navy in Pearl Harbor. He went to this band concert in Honolulu the night before. And after the concert, well, he talked with Harvey. And then the next day, the next morning, he was gone.
Wow. I'm really glad you shared that because I think it's important for people to understand that when we get to December 7th every year and we talk about it, it's not just ships going up in flames. It's not just a number, more than 2,000 sailors who died that day. It's real people. It was your best friend who died that day. In the years since, have you been to the USS Arizona Memorial?
Yes, yeah.
What was that like for you? What did you think about while you were there?
Oh, I don't think I can tell you. I don't think I can put it into words. I was in the Navy at the time, and this was during the war, and the Arizona was on the bottom, but they'd put a plank, 2-inch by 12-inch planks, out to the ship, which was not very far. So I got aboard the Arizona, that part of it. And then that's all I saw.
So you walked out on those planks, and you're standing basically right above this sunken ship, and you know that your friend is still down there.
Yes.
If you ever have the privilege of visiting the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, you can find the name of J. Harvey Sanderson etched on that wall. One of the next major turning points in World War II came at the Battle of Midway, but that came at a very heavy price, including almost every single member of Torpedo Squadron 8 from the aircraft carrier USS Hornet. Ensign George Gay would famously become the sole survivor of that squadron at Midway. But we once met another member of the squadron, a pilot who would go on later in the war to earn the Navy Cross. Eddie Fail is now buried at Arlington National Cemetery. But here's a portion of the story he told us on Hometown Heroes, explaining why he wasn't flying with the squadron at Midway.
No, I was in the hospital. There were about four or five. I don't remember. The only one I remember is Whitey Moore. He was dead set on going out and getting some pineapple. Never had pineapple fresh off the field. And I wanted to try sugar cane because I've seen all the kids going down the street sucking on sugar cane and never tried it. We learned it at Everfield, and there was a big farm right next to the field, full of pineapples and sugar cane. As I see, five or six, I forgot exactly the number, went out on a midnight requisition.
A midnight requisition usually isn't something that your CO has approved. So this was an improvisational requisition.
Right.
Huh?
We're going to say crime does not pay, but in this case it did pay. We were stealing some sugar cane and some pineapple off the farmer. Well, to make a long story short, we got a few pineapples, and I start cutting a couple of a stick of sugar cane, and one of the guys yelled and said, "Hey, here comes a farmer. I think he's got a gun." You never saw five or six guys scramble over the fence quite as fast. As I vaulted over the fence with a knife in my hand and sugar cane in the other, I just stabbed myself in the leg.
Oh.
Pretty deep. I hit the bone, as a matter of fact. They put me in the hospital, and the next day the squadron took off and went to the Battle of Midway. A few days later, I'm still in the hospital recovering. George Gay come walking into the room. And of course, I had heard about the Battle of Midway. It was all over the scuttlebutt. So I said, "Gee, George, I'm sorry I missed it." And he said, "Don't be sorry. I'm the only one that's left." That kind of shook me a little.
I could see that.
But as I said before, I think I would have made it back.
How hard was that? Because, you know, we hear that story and we say, boy, all those planes go down. His plane went down. No one knew he survived till he came out of the water after all those hours. But to know that all those men that you had trained with for all that time were not coming back.
That kind of hit hard.
Did that change at all your perspective on the war, the enemy, or what you were doing there?
No, not really. It was just It's like losing a lot of friends that you, it's more than friends, almost like family. I mean, we've been together for 6 months.
And did Ensign Gay give you an account of what he'd been through?
Yeah.
What he'd witnessed?
He was telling me what he saw, actually. So the skipper, who was flying ahead of him, it looked like the skipper was trying to get out of his plane. If he was going to bail out, but it was not a question of bailing out. He was flying right off the water, so we don't know what happened.
I don't want to do our listeners a disservice here. I've heard the story of Midway from people that were there, but maybe a lot of the listeners haven't. When you're flying one of these TBDs, can you explain to us what your job would be in a situation like that where there are Japanese ships that you're attacking? How would you attack those ships?
Well, you would try to get ahead of them, for one thing, and try to get a bow shot. 30-degree angle is about ideal. If you're trying to get close to the water and drop your torpedo close enough to the ship, so that not too close, because the torpedo has to arm itself. There's a little prop in front of the thing that uncovers the contact point. So ideally, you're dropping your torpedo 100 feet from the ship.
And how far above the water are you?
20 feet at most.
So you dive down far before you get to the ship.
Yeah.
You're flying parallel to the water,
right,
releasing your torpedo, and then hoping that somehow all those guns on those ships don't take you down.
Well, they continue shooting at you.
I mean, I'm sure people listen to that are like, well, that's ridiculous. Of course you're going to get shot down with the speed that those planes were flying. Then not to mention all the aircraft from the enemy, all those Zeros who had more horsepower and could go faster. It really wasn't a fair fight, was it, at Midway?
Well, it's a fair fight. I mean, you take your chances when you're at war. There's no question about it. Well, let's put it this way. I would rather be a fighter.
Mm-hmm. And what does that say about those men who died that day, that they carried out that job, despite what I'm sure they knew were difficult odds?
They were brave men. All the people that fought the war were brave.
Did it take you a while to get over that?
Yes.
Have you gotten over it yet?
Well, I've gotten over it as much as I don't think about it all the time, but when I think of it, it still catches me.
Mm-hmm. And it touches us, doesn't it? It is exactly what Memorial Day is all about. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more memories of America's Gold Star heroes of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Memorial Day weekend edition of the program. If you know a Gold Star family, don't miss that opportunity this weekend to let them know you're thinking about them and that their family's sacrifice was not in vain. Over the years, we've met quite a few veterans who lost brothers in the war, including a Purple Heart Iwo Jima Marine named Jim Friel, who would end up reaching the century mark, but always cognizant that his brother Bill never had that chance. Jim and Bill were very close.
Yeah, he was 14 months younger than I, and my next brother was 8 years younger than me.
So I'm just guessing you and Bill probably did a lot of things together.
We did everything together. Just grew up together. We're pretty close.
And it seems to me, of all the people your age that I've interviewed, almost everybody has some kind of memory about December 7th, 1941, and how they found out what happened. How about you?
My brother and I were staying. My parents were gone. They'd gone to one of the grandparents and left us at home alone. At that time, we were living up here at McClouth in a little town where my dad had been working, and listened to the radio, listened to Dinah Shore singing St. Louis Blues. They interrupted the show to announce the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Nobody knew where Pearl Harbor was. I'd never heard of it before. Of course, didn't get the papers for a couple days later and found out about it. And my brother and I both wanted to go right away, but of course, Mom wouldn't let us.
Had you guys read about the Marines? Did you know who the Marines were?
Only that they were different, and we joined the Marines because they were different. And the reputation that the Marine Corps has, and that we figured they were the best, and I still feel that way about the Marine Corps. First to fight.
And in your family, Bill was first, right? He went in before you?
Before I did. I don't really know why, but I wanted to finish high school, and I did.
When did you decide to go in, and why?
As soon as my mother would let me. You know, back then you didn't do what your parents didn't want you to do.
As you're heading overseas, what was going through your mind? Did you have confidence you were going to come back?
Of course. You think you're invincible when you're a Marine.
And your brother had already seen combat by then.
He had been on Guadalcanal, yeah, originally. He hit three of the big ones. He hit Guadalcanal, Peleliu, and then Okinawa, the final one. He was killed 3 days after his 21st birthday. And we wanted to go. You know, about time we get to We hadn't seen any Japanese yet. Well, we were aboard ship, of course, and we got ready to land, so we had to go over the side of the ship, crawl down the cargo nets into the landing craft, wait till they load up one craft, and then they'd join a circle, what they call rendezvous, until they got the whole wave, and then they would just be going in circles. They'd just split out and split off and head for shore in wave. And I was in the second wave on the left flank.
So what did you see as you were approaching the island?
Just smoke, and you could see shells and stuff and see activity, but, you know, you couldn't hear what was going on. And we didn't realize that the lava was going to be so difficult to walk on or crawl on, and it would cut right through your dungarees. It was kind of a shelf there where you had to crawl up. And they couldn't get mechanized equipment later to go on it because, you know, they just bury itself. So they had to get those big sheets of metal, corrugated kind of metal, that they'd lay like they'd put on airfields and stuff,
yeah,
in order to get their heavy equipment, motorized equipment.
I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. You're getting closer and closer. You told me smoke. You said the shells are coming over.
You could see the explosion, but you couldn't hear them, of course, from that point.
And are you getting fired upon as you're coming ashore?
No, we were ashore before they opened up from the mountain, and then they cut loose. Well, they had them all buried back in tunnels and bunkers and stuff. They had a lot of time to build it and get prepared.
So you come ashore, and what are you supposed to do? Where are you headed?
My unit was supposed to bisect the island and then make a left turn and go up the mountain, take the mountain. And I never made it across the island, much less up the mountain. And I got wounded.
Yeah, tell me what happened.
Well, you know, it's just kind of like a bee sting. You reach up here and a handful of blood. You reach back here, see if you still got a head. It's okay. Corman came by and put a bandage around your neck. And then they made you go back to the aid station, put you by board ship. There's sounds, but just explosive sounds, like artillery or mortars, a lot of mortar fire. And that's what I got hit by, was mortars, shrapnel.
What were you doing at the time?
But going across the island like I was supposed to. Jumping from, see, you couldn't dig a foxhole, so the only thing you could hide in from or jump in was another shell hole, as soon as you're just trying to advance.
Because if you tried to dig a foxhole, it'd just fill in because, yeah, of the nature of the sand?
Yeah, it just cover you up.
So you're taking cover in one shell hole after another?
Right, across the island. We were supposed to dissect the island and turn left.
And you said it felt like a bee sting, and this is, well, right on your neck?
I see it went right in here, and it's lodged right in the back here.
So it went right in under your right jaw, and it's lodged on the back left side of your neck.
Never thought about it at the time, but I've been so grateful. I got shot in the front. I didn't get shot in the back. I've thought about that a lot.
It's a matter of pride for a Marine?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking, if this shrapnel comes through under your chin, through your neck, ends up on the other side of your neck, on the back left side, it had to pass your jugular and your spinal cord and not damage it. And that's probably not easy to do.
Well, I wasn't in charge of the transportation arrangements for the... It took what was given me.
And you've got an X-ray on your wall here in Topeka that shows that shrapnel is still there. How do you explain that wound and how it didn't do more damage, how it didn't kill you or paralyze you or any of that?
By the grace of God. By the grace of God.
And correct me if I'm wrong, in listening to your description here, it sounds like you weren't too worried about how it felt. You were kind of disappointed they made you go to the aid station.
Right. Yeah, because I was still ambulatory. I never was on a stretcher till I went back to the boat. I mean, to the ship. Difference between a boat and a ship. If you don't believe that, try to explain it to a soldier or a sailor.
And a submarine's a boat, I've been informed many times. Did you lose much blood?
I don't remember losing. Of course, it was a handful, but no, I didn't. I didn't require a tourniquet or anything. They're going to put a tourniquet around my neck. They got to fight me.
But there was a corpsman right there with you?
He came up on right quick-like. And boy, those guys are good. I'll tell you how much we as Marines think of corpsmen. Corpsmen and chaplains are the only ones invited into the Marine Corps League other than Marines.
So they take you to the aid station, then they put you back on the ship. What are you thinking? What's going through your mind?
I want to get doctored up so I can get back ashore, get back and join my unit. Didn't think about leaving or going. I was sat out there in that harbor on that hospital ship 4 days until they put the flag up.
And that flag?
The original one, you know. And then they come back and took the one that newspaper guy.
So some guys, you know, have shared with me, they got wounded, it sent them home. It was a $1 million wound, and they were excited to come home. I'm not getting the sense that you were excited to come home.
No, I wanted to be there until the end. Finish the job, never leave any. You know, I was trained or taught when I was in school, never played. Don't do anything you can't finish. Don't leave a job half done.
So tell me about that. They send you home, and you come back here to Topeka, right?
Yeah. Came back and was here on a 30-day leave, including travel time. Mm-hmm. And travel at that time was either by bus or something like that, unless you could afford a plane, and nobody did. You'd hitchhike across the country. You could go anywhere in uniform in those days.
In fact, I think I read that you hitchhiked to your home, and your mom was a bit surprised.
Oh, absolutely. She almost fainted when I came to the door. But I hitchhiked from Corvallis, Oregon. That's where the hospital was. Spent the night in jail in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Stopped there. It was snowing, and the old town marshal come by. He says, come on down in the station. We sat there and talked. He had a son in the Marine Corps. We talked till 2 o'clock in the morning. He says, go in there and lay down in one of those cells. He said, I won't lock the door.
I'm sure when you said spent the night in jail, people had all kinds of ideas. Oh, yeah. But yeah, so you made it all the way back, and your parents didn't know you were coming.
They had no idea. You know, that I used to get aggravated at my mother. She'd call the Red Cross because I hadn't written. Well, the military wouldn't let you tell where you were or what you were doing or anything about the terrain because that would give away your location of your troop. So if you can't write anything, why even write? Although you could write free on the corner and you wouldn't have to buy a stamp. Some things weren't logical to me. Uh-huh. But that's life.
So your mother almost fainted, but I'm sure she was relieved to have you home.
The sad part about it, I was home when they got notification that my brother had been killed. You know, it was a shock to her when those two officers came up the sidewalk in uniform, dressed blue uniform, to let her know that her son had been killed.
You were there.
And I was home, which may have been helpful to her. Or maybe she thought like I thought. Why not me? When, you know, I'm oldest. I've been here longer. He's got a lot longer to live than me. So I don't know.
Well, you just partially answered my next question. You said maybe it helped her to have you there, but I'm wondering how this affected you, because this is your brother, 14 months younger, that you grew up with, did everything with. He went in the Marines first. He'd already survived Guadalcanal and Peleliu, and you find out he was killed at Okinawa. How did that affect you?
See, he was involved in the first battle of the war, Guadalcanal. That was our first engagement. And killed on the last battle of the war, Okinawa. So it didn't really seem fair, but then who's to say who's fair?
And did you ever get any details about what happened to him?
He was killed by mortar shrapnel. I think there was along about that same time, one of their generals and a newscaster was killed. Yeah. Remember? Ernie Pyle, on that same action.
And you've had a very productive life since the war. Have you ever contemplated what kinds of things Bill would have done had he survived?
We'd had a good time together. I know that. We had a good time growing up. I have no idea. I don't know what his aspiration would have been.
You can't lose anyone closer to you than your brother. But it also occurs to me, you have a picture on your wall of your unit your platoon that went ashore at Iwo Jima, and you told me everyone in that photo was either killed or wounded. Are there some other guys that you knew well that you lost in the war that you still think about today? So you're pointing at the wall. You want me to pull this photo down. I'll do that. And for everybody listening, we're going to post this photo on Facebook and at hometownheroesradio.com. So it's got your picture on the back, has the names of everybody. It shows where you are. It says wounded in action or killed in action next to everybody. And there's three that have question marks. Everyone else was either wounded or killed. You're looking at those names right there. Are there some that you still can picture in your mind or think about?
Well, yeah, because we trained with those guys for several months before you went into action. There's Lieutenant Worry. He's a little old second lieutenant, real nice young kid. And, he's our leader, and he gets killed. So there's no rank doesn't have any kind of privileges there.
Well, and I look at the names here where it says KIA next to him, and I look at another picture you have on your wall, and I've seen this view before. It says 5th Marine Division. It has Mount Suribachi in the background. It has a giant flagpole with the stars and stripes flying. But in between all of that are rows and rows and rows of white crosses, that temporary cemetery on Iwo Jima. When you look at that picture, what does that mean to you? What does it represent or signify?
They made the ultimate sacrifice.
Which is what Memorial Day is all about. It's time for our final break. Just another encouragement for you to find a meaningful way to observe Memorial Day where you live this weekend. And we're going to hear about two more men who made the ultimate sacrifice when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, remembering America's Gold Star heroes on this Memorial Day weekend. I've mentioned before that this program wouldn't have come into existence without a trail of inspiration that traces back to my family's Gold Star hero, one of America's first military pilots in World War I, my great-great-uncle Vincent Dushek. Now let's learn about another one of World War II's Gold Star heroes, Benjamin Kaiser, through the memories of Vernon Jackson, who served with Kaiser in the 109th Combat Engineer Battalion.
We didn't get out of combat or out of danger just because we got in headquarters company. But Joe Paul and I were assigned to clear a rather large beach. I don't know what they wanted it for. Go swimming, maybe. It had been tank mines, heavily, very heavily. Joe and I were assigned to clear that beach. It was 100 yards long, at least. Maybe 200. The lieutenant took us out, left us off with the equipment that we needed. We spent the whole morning blowing up mines, 10 at a time, with a block of TNT in each one, electrically connected, so you'd blow 10 at once with your little detonator machine.
You make that sound real simple, but it sure seems to me like it would be pretty nerve-wracking not knowing where all these are and how they're all going to go up.
It was a sandy beach, and enough of them were exposed, so you got a pretty good feel for what things were. But that was routine. We had to do that. We hunted for mines. Mine detector, find them, and then dig them out.
So it was never a big deal to you.
Where the detonators were for the tank, they were right on top. But for booby traps, there was a place on the side where a detonator was screwed in with a tripwire or whatever. And we knew where we had to go on the mine. We'd feel the way around it, unscrew the detonator. Well, first you'd do something to neutralize the firing pin.
And how delicate is that? Is this the kind of thing where if you bump the wrong piece or you twist it the wrong way that you're going to be up in smoke?
Let me get to one instance. We'd worked all morning doing this and probably blew up 300 mines or more. We got a tenth of the mine field taken care of. And the lieutenant came out at noon and he realized, gosh, I gave these guys too big a job. We'll send out a line platoon to help them. So another half an hour later, 40 men come out. Well, Benny Kaiser and John Macnick were introduced to Joe and I, and we introduced them to the minefield where we had been lifting. And the minefield had changed from just anti-tanks. In between this minefield, and this is why the lieutenant realized we had too big a job for two guys, were anti-personnel mines, the kind that jump out of the ground 6 feet and blow up in all directions, sending little pellets that can do a lot of damage to a lot of people. We'd worked in this pattern of mines where the anti-personnel mines were in between. We'd worked into it 10, 15 feet out of a 30-foot. Anyhow, we'd worked into it. We'd opened it up. We introduced it to them, and they were capable guys, highly capable. And we went down to the other end of the minefield where there was a pier where bomb disposal people had put some bombs out on the end of it and blew them up. And the concussion had caused the anti-tank mines to detonate. And so there were sand piles there and a slight depressions of, say, 3 foot deep, maybe. Well, I was down there digging through the sand for these three wires because we needed to know whether there were anti-personnel mines down in that part of the field, too. And I unscrewed the detonator and hold it up in the air and fire it, go off about like a rifle shell. Well, I had done that to two or three mines, anti-personnel mines, when there was a bang up where we'd been, where Benny and John had taken over. And I think we saw body pieces in the air. Maybe just visualize it. But we ran up there, and sure as heck, two men had been wounded. John was out of the field, leaning against something with holes in him, dying. He was gasping. He was going. But Benny was blown to pieces. He was just erupted from stem to stern. He was intestines all over the place. Very, very dead. Well, the two wounded needed to be taken to field hospital, so we had a pickup truck, weapons carrier, we called him, and we hauled off the two guys. Then we came back, and his platoon had not touched the two bodies. So we got the pleasure of loading John into the pickup and putting Benny together in a couple of blankets, and putting him in, taking those two to grave registration. We didn't think about anything at the time. It's just you don't. But years later, 10 years ago, when I was going for hearing aids from the Veterans Administration, I was reviewing the concussions that I'd experienced, the explosions, and I could see Benny getting blown and, well, realize that he had 7 seconds, 5 to 7 seconds, from the time this mine popped to the time it would come out of the ground. And he could run, but it was a poor chance because the pellets would come from everywhere. He knew that his platoon would be in great jeopardy. He put his body, I believe, I realized in retrospect, that he had undoubtedly put his body on that mine to keep it in the ground where the pellets would not go far. And realizing that, I started an effort to have him recognized posthumously as a hero. I carried it to the politician in Rapid City and was getting some action. And she lost her office. The election came, she lost her office. And I never got to follow it up fully, and I've given up on it. I feel bad about it. I would like to do it yet. But I did get to his family. One, his brother lived in Merced. Other family members, they weren't brother or sister, they were cousins and such, in the Rapid City area. And they were very happy to know, to meet someone who knew how their brother died, or their uncle or cousin or whatever. So I did something kind of worthwhile in contacting family members.
Whether or not a medal ever materializes or recognition, just what you did in sharing that story with his family, I'm sure was very, very meaningful for them. And I can tell that his story is still meaningful to you. And I often reflect with veterans on this show about that verse in the Bible, John 15:13, where greater love has no man than this, than he laid down his life for his friend. And it sounds like there's no doubt in your mind that's what Ben did.
Yes, yes, I it's true. Why it detonated is a question. Hang fire is a good explanation, the best explanation. The three little wires stick up. In soft ground, you depress those wires, and it sets a little charge off that burns from the top of the mine, which is about 10 inches deep, 6 inches across, maybe a little smaller than that. The powder train that burns from the detonator, wires having been pressed, a little cap in there that fires, burns down to the bottom of the mine, and then there's powder there, which blows the mine into the air. And that could have been partly depressed, just hanging, waiting to be jolted. That's my best explanation. Because he was a highly capable fellow. I have record from his high school athletic days. He was loved and respected by his classmates in a major way. He was an extremely fine type young man. And I can visualize him having given his life for his troops very easily.
Not that it matters whether it was 1 or 20, but, I mean, do you have a gauge on potentially how many lives were saved by his sacrifice?
No, not at all. No, there were the two that were close and were killed, Benny and his friend. You work together generally in something like that. There were two fellows that were wounded, and they were wounded low in the body, I think. One of them was, I know. I visited them, too. They, incidentally, one of them said, I always thought he'd done that. Why we didn't take action or cause the officers to recognize what had happened and take action, I don't know. It baffles me yet, but it's the way things are in combat.
What would you like to see happen for him? How would you like him to be recognized?
I'd like to see him at least get a Silver Star posthumous. Had that thing gone off above ground, it would have wiped out any number.
I don't know about you, but it's hard to hear a story like that without wondering what I'd do in those circumstances. And the same can be said about the saga of a pair of college football teammates who became Navy fighter pilots flying off of the same carrier. Thanks to a thoroughly researched book by Charles Houston and a few memories from that near ace, we learn about a Navy Cross recipient named Gene Streeter, whom Chuck had known for quite a while.
Oh, for years. We went to school, Fresno State, together and played football together, joined the Navy together, went through training together and through the squadron. He was a friend from way back. Just a great guy, just full of laughs and smart, capable guy, a very good friend.
What kind of pilot was he?
An excellent pilot. All of our pilots were excellent.
So I'm just going to go ahead and read this whole thing. It's from October 26, 1944, and you label it Gene Streeter's bad dream. Streeter wasn't scheduled to fly until later that day, so I was surprised when I woke up about 0400 and saw him already up and sitting at our desk. I knew he should have been sound asleep like our other roommate, Jiggs Lears. When I asked Gene why he was up so early, he told me about his terrible dream. In it, his plane had been diving out of control, and he couldn't pull out. The dream seemed so real that he had jumped down from the upper bunk, run down the passageway, all while still asleep, and finally woke up in the head being observed by two sailors standing water guard. Gene told me that after he returned to our room, he was so upset by this dream that he couldn't get back to sleep. He was still sitting there, wide awake, when I got up from my flight. So in your writing here, you're kind of foreshadowing what's happening here, because you and Gruber make it back from this hairy mission, and you get back on the Wasp, and some of your pilots were playing poker in the front of the room, and Gene Streeter was sitting on the arm of a chair watching the card action. You write, "I called out to him, 'Hey, Gene, it's really rough out there.' I expected him to come back with one of his usual funny remarks, but all he did was nod very seriously without smiling. This was so unusually solemn for him. That was the last time I ever saw Gene Streeter." Your book is over 400 pages long. It's a very thick, heavy, thorough book. And I don't know if there's anywhere else in this book that I saw you quote a verse from the Bible. But as you get into Eugene Streeter's last flight, the first thing printed there is John 15:13. "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." Is that what Gene Streeter did?
Yes, he went in there to help his friends and was killed.
So again, this book is not just your memories, but so many others. And this was written by Bill Finnegan Miller, Torpedo Squadron VT-14. He was an aviation radio man. And he wrote, "We were to hit the Japanese fleet in the Sibuan Sea. As we circled over them, we waited for Lieutenant Cole to dive, but something was amiss. He circled again for some unknown reason. Maybe he was already hit by anti-aircraft. So Lieutenant Morrison made our dive on a ship. Ack-ack was everywhere. We dropped our bombs. As we pulled out, I saw Lieutenant Cole's aircraft plunge into the sea just behind the enemy ship. I saw the ship firing shell after shell at Lieutenant Cole's plane, and I screamed, 'Let's go back and strafe those bastards. They're shooting at them in the water.' They were all probably dead from the crash, but aboard that plane was my closest buddy, William T. Billy. We were to meet in Al Depp's hamburger stand on Staten Island when we were relieved. He was from Bayonne across the river from my home on Staten Island. We had planned this meeting for months. Suddenly, beneath us, and heading straight for us, were three Jap fighters. The other planes were out of ammo, except for my turret gunner, E.J. Such, and me. We had no fighter coverage, and it looked like we were hung out to dry. We were mincemeat for those Zeros. I guess we all blessed ourselves. Then, from nowhere, as if by a miracle, this VF-14 F-6F Hellcat came tearing between us and the Zeros. He set himself in between them, pulling them away from us. He battled the lead plane and was ganged up on by the others. He got one Zero, but the others shot him down. I feel he knew he had to save us and sacrificed his own life so that we would get home. Thanks to the bravery of that fighter pilot, at least I would get to Al Depp's on Staten Island for that hamburger. I soon found out that pilot was Lieutenant J.G. Eugene Jarvis Streeter, VF-14, from Fresno, California. In that 1 second, he was more than enough fighter coverage. His courage will always be remembered by the combat air crewmen who watched in awe as Eugene Jarvis Streeter gave his life for me and the others in those torpedo planes. You see, our lucky streak continues as we return to the Wasp. I wish our luck could have returned Lieutenant Cole and Lieutenant Eugene Jarvis Streeter with us to the USS Wasp. I was getting a little emotional reading that. I mean, I wish I had Gene Streeter here to ask him. If there's anyone qualified to speak for him, it's got to be you. You grew up with him, went to school with him, trained with him, and you performed the same job he did as an F-6F pilot. So what kind of guts or courage or selflessness did it take for him to do what he did?
Well, the ultimate in courage and determination, you can't do any more than that.
Gene Streeter was credited with 4 aerial victories in World War II, and he had actually been given the Silver Star 8 days prior. But his actions that day, his final day, were recognized with the Navy Cross. The only decoration higher than that is the Medal of Honor. And his Navy Cross citation reads, "Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter suddenly found himself as the only protection for 8 torpedo bombers which were making a strike against large units of the Japanese fleet. When 3 hostile fighters came in from above, he pressed home an accurate, daring attack, which destroyed one of the planes, and courageously employed evasive maneuvers with the remaining fighters, vainly attempting to lose them. Although his plane was so severely damaged that he was forced to effect a water landing, he succeeded in diverting the enemy aircraft from the torpedo bombers until assistance arrived, thereby enabling our planes to carry out their highly important mission. The conduct of Lieutenant Junior Grade Streeter throughout this action reflects great credit upon himself and was in keeping with the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. And the final line of that Navy Cross citation really says it all. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Such a powerful story. And Chuck, your old college football teammate really did live up to that passage you quoted from John 15:13. But at the time, you didn't know that for sure. One report that day suggested he may have been able to get out of his plane and make it to land. You write about how you pilots expected him to come walking back in someday. How you even experienced a recurring dream of exactly that happening, and it felt real. And his mother, Florence, maintained a shrine to him in her home, hoping someday her son would return. Because you were his roommate, you had to gather up his things, and you actually had the chance to visit his mother back here in Fresno.
I think that was harder than anything else. Just shooting down planes in combat is easier in comparison. I had a very high opinion of Streeter. There was always the sadness of knowing that his life was ended and he never had a chance to go on and do the things that I did later.
Those what-ifs apply to every single one of the more than 400,000 Americans who paid the ultimate price in World War II, not to mention all of those who have done so since. We talk a lot about the price of freedom, but it's up to us to establish a value for that freedom that comes close to that price that was paid. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that on Memorial Day and every day, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.